Max Show, welcome. Really Rich Podcast. Doing the away game, the New York City edition. Flew all the way here to hang out with my bro, Max Show, from Coverage Cat. So, full disclosure, I just invested in Coverage Cat.
Thank
wrote
you.
The check. Thank you, he says. I signed all the legal documents.
Necessary.
Very necessary. So, Max Show and I have a little dirty secret in common. We used to work in finance, Max over on the hedge fund side, and we both escaped with our lives. So we thought this would be a good opportunity to sit down. I want to hear everything about Coverage Cat because I thought it was so interesting myself. I put some money in it and I want to hear it from Max. And at the end of the podcast, I want to do something that I think we're going to do from now on. Okay. Go through a little bit of the really rich stuff and I want to get Max's hot takes to see if he agrees or disagrees with the really rich mentality, way of life, humility in practice, humility in business, collaboration. He's already like, oh God, here it comes.
We're here to alienate people.
Right. We're here to alienate people. No, but what I want to do at the end of this is like, Max is a successful entrepreneur. I'm curious to see what of this value system makes sense to him. And we're going to do that at the end of the podcast. So Max, tell me a little bit. And everybody, tell me a little bit about you, your background, coming from hedge fund world, going into tech, not just, you know, and he's a Y Combinator alum. That's like the...
Certainly they would love to say that they're the Harvard of startups. Okay. Absolutely.
They're the Harvard of startup incubators. So anyway, please just give us a little bit of background of what, you know, how the hell you went from a hedge fund to tech and what's going on. Before we get started, guys, YouTube, like, subscribe. If you're watching this on Spotify, 5-star review if you loved it. We're going to keep doing these things and bringing on awesome entrepreneurs like Max Cho.
So I started off at Microsoft, collecting all of the software problems in the world. And never thought I would go into finance. I thought finance was the worst place in the world, full of, you know, cigar smoking jockeys of the worst sort.
My kind of people.
Exactly. I thought it was full of people like you. No. But came out to New York for an interview for these guys. I don't know if you know this, but you can do interview tourism. You can just sign up to take a job interview and they'll fly you out, put you up in a nice hotel. And I never thought I would take this job.
Okay.
But it turned out the people at the fund I worked at were my kind of folk.
Okay.
And so I was there for a couple of years and just, it totally changed my mind on what finance is like. I think it's an experience that was really revelatory. In
so
that
you,
sense.
You went right to a hedge fund.
I went to a hedge fund after a couple of years at Microsoft.
Okay.
I never worked in iBanking. I never was an analyst. Exactly.
Lucky you.
Thank you.
How'd you get away with that? You must've really crushed that interview.
After the 2008 crisis, hedge funds became where it was at. Hedge funds grew a bunch. iBanking shrank because they were no longer Frank Dodd trading on their own money. And so hedge funds realized they needed to become tech companies. And to become tech companies, they had to hire like tech companies.
So, okay. So you end up going, which fund did you end up going to?
Two Sigma. It's one of the larger funds in the world.
So you go to Two Sigma, you join a quant desk? What desk do you join?
I was in engineering. Okay. We worked on all the software to simulate financial markets and predict whether you're going to make a buck or not next tomorrow.
Okay. So everyone who's sitting at home that has their five computers trying to trade Dogecoin, this is the fucking guy you're going up against. He's literally building technology. Probably, I've heard that these guys actually, they don't just write code. They actually build hardware to be faster than the next guy.
Oh, yeah.
They have their own fiber optic lines, maybe microwave lines. Like if you think you're sitting in your room, you know, flopping your Dogecoin around, Max Cho is literally designing technology and hardware to ensure that you don't make a cent off of that trade.
That's partially true. I think actually for what it's worth, retail investors have an advantage that institutions don't. Retail investors get to buy at retail prices. So that means that Citadel is happy to take your trades because they think you're an idiot.
Right.
And retail investors are trading generally a smaller book. It's harder to move $1 billion. You move the market more than if you're trading $1 million. And right. So there are trades that retail investors can make that institutions can never find a buck on.
Okay. So this is basically market impact, right? When you're trading a couple $100 a stock, you don't make a dent in the market. You're trading a couple $100 million of stock. You start to sway the market in the direction, start to get a shitty price.
Yeah. And in fact, you get a better price than an institution will find because the counterparty on the other end of your trade, if you're coming in and saying, oh, I'm Citadel, people are like, mm-hmm. I don't know if I want to take the other end of that. Mm-hmm. But if you're coming in and saying, this is my Fidelity account, I press buy.
Yeah. Grandma.
Anyone's happy about it.
Grandma Joe is coming in and so lifting the offer.
The spreads are tighter. Citadel in theory is giving you a best offer there.
Okay, so there are some advantages.
I wouldn't recommend, just to be clear, I wouldn't recommend making your life this. Not, I actually think it's for a more complicated reason than me.
Well,
as
let's
the,
hear
as
it because I can't tell you how many DMs I get. Nick, tell me how to trade. Tell me how to trade options. I'm like, wait, guys, do you think that I'm trading right now? Like, I'm looking out the window, on Collins Ave, there's people walking by in bathing suits. You know, I have no information. I don't have, I'm not sitting there at 2 Sigma.
Right. Yeah, a lot is being revealed.
Yeah, it's not the information I need to make any money. I have distracting information in front of me in Miami. Explain this a little bit further, because it's one thing for me to say it over and over again. That's another to hear another technician who's been at one of the biggest hedge funds.
I think the strongest reason that you shouldn't day trade, that you shouldn't try and become a professional stock trader or crypto trader or whatever, mm-hmm. is because it's a waste of your life. If you spend all of your time trading currency or trading stocks, I don't think you've had a life well lived. Mm. And unless that is like your obsession, that is your sole goal in life, there are better things to do on earth. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I tell people this, they should structure their finances to think as little about it as possible, it's because there's just so many more interesting things out there.
One of my whole things is like, you basically, the point of being a human being is to add value, to make someone else's life easier. That's my whole mantra. And it sounds like you maybe a little agree with that, just a little bit.
Yeah, I would say that there is a deep and professional pleasure in actually doing something of value. Mm-hmm. And I think if you spend your day as a retail trader, you're probably not going to find that satisfaction.
Right.
Except for there's some extraordinary folks out there who really do. I think there's some folks who live for the trade. There's also probably millions of people who have a legitimate gambling addiction and probably should get out of the business.
Right. But they get away with it because it's like working in a bar, basically.
Sure.
And look, price discovery, market making, like this is all critical, right, to society's function. But do we need as many tech? Is the industry need to be as big as it is with young guys fresh out of school who can literally change the world, and instead they choose to go sit in front of a desk and build a computer to make a little couple bucks pop out of it?
It's a profitable career, and I won't begrudge anyone that. I don't think the retail investors are generally either finding the profit in it or really actually contributing that much to price discovery. Maybe GameStop people will prove me wrong.
Why do you think there's such an obsession? Why does the average Joe want to become a trader? How is that still possible? It's so many years after, like when I was graduating from college, I mean, that's all we talked about. That's all there was. That was the only game in town. And it's like, now there's so much more. Like, where do you even begin? There's so much more to jump into. How are people still obsessed? Is it there's a romanticism? Is there some kind of like American lore to sitting in front of a computer? And
there's two classes here. Class one is if you want to go into boutique private equity, if you want to go do certain kinds of venture capital, mm-hmm. you have to break your teeth in the iBanking vein. Mm-hmm. And so some people know that it's not their interest. They care nothing for finance, but they're going to go do this because it's essential to the thing that they actually want to go do.
So it's like, hey, I got to stop here on my road to the golden.
Right. It's paying your dues.
The big show.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're one of those kinds of people, you already know that plan. You know that whatever, Apollo doesn't post career listings. They only contact people currently in iBanking. Mm. But if you're not in that show, you probably know that too. And for those folks, I think the allure comes from a sense that there's a cheap path to money. And I just really don't know.
Cheap path or a path where you have to think, but you don't have to think that hard.
Yeah, it feels easy.
It is easy, in my opinion.
It's easy to press buy. It's easy to press sell. It's easy to brag about your wins. It's very hard to build a book of business that stands the test of time.
Right. Because most people in that business are just going through the motions, going through the machine, and very few are the creative thinkers that are actually making real money.
I think it's actually many retail investors don't even have the tools to understand if they're winning or losing. Mm. You can look at your P&L and say, oh, I made $50K today, but on a risk-adjusted basis, are you doing well? Right. Are you just getting lucky? Or do you actually have the sophistication to separate out that world?
Right. So what that means is you walk into a casino, you put $50K on black, right, and it hits black, and you say, I'm a great gambler.
Because the game stops there. If someone came up to you on TikTok and said, I just made this great roll on roulette, you would laugh at them. You would say, what an idiot you are. Anyone can do that.
Right.
But if you see someone come in and say, I just made $100,000 on GameStop, suddenly this sounds like, oh, maybe this is the thing I should be doing.
Right.
But it truthfully probably isn't.
Well, it's a combination of things. It's social proof, and it's also the impression that you have some kind of information or control over something that you literally know nothing about.
Right. and I think there's a rustic sense in which if somebody comes up to you bragging about how much money they've made, mm-hmm, your first real response should be, what are you selling to me? What are you shilling? and that allergic response,
right,
is strong, is good. Like, that is appropriate, I think.
Okay, so let's talk about, I heard the word TikTok. Let's talk about influencers, financial influencers, trading, you know, whatever, these business gurus. What do these guys get wrong about financial investing? What do these guys get wrong about real estate? Like, because I'm like, I don't know how the hell I found myself in this world, but I find myself in this world. And, you know, I'm a really bad, like, I don't play the game. I don't make it simple. I don't just say, yes, real estate is good. Like, trading is good. Like, I don't make it easy. I give you the nitty gritty on it and let you think for yourself. What do you think most of these people get wrong besides just saying, you know, see that Huracan in the driveway? Yeah, I made that today from trading bonds or trading a stock. Like, let's hear it from your angle.
Yeah, I think financial influencers are unfortunately victims of the platforms they participate on. Mm. And that means that they have to create the most base and reductionist view of what is actually a very intricate system.
Okay. Basically creating financial clickbait.
They are creating financial clickbait, and the more it can be 6 or fewer seconds, the better off they do.
Right.
But unfortunately, the beauty of finance, and I think the people who really love finance actually know that it is a business about creating complexity. Mm. Lending money is
pretty simple.
As old as civilization.
Right.
But a structured derivative product in which you found a new way to slice the seniority of the bonds,
right,
the dividends that people are getting, you actually create value out of nothing. And that is created through complexity, not through simplicity.
Right. And selling complexity, in my opinion, is a form of theft, because selling complexity is value thieving. And it's something that is ultimately a trick. A really elegant trick that you're playing on someone else.
Yeah, I mean, the irony of complexity is, of course, when you create complex systems, you can then sell your expertise to solve the problems that you've just created, right?
Yes.
Listerine invents the problem of halitosis.
Right.
And then sells you mouthwash.
Right. And my breath, for the record, is fresh AF right now.
You're drinking coffee, right?
I don't know.
We'll keep our distance.
He's far enough for me not to have the full experience in HD.
So this
is a really important point, because I think a lot of people find themselves in a career that they don't like and they don't know why. And in my opinion, you have to audit what it is that you're doing on a fundamental level and say, am I selling complexity? Am I selling bullshit? I started an SEO agency that ended up becoming a growth agency because I realized when I was selling SEO, I was selling complexity. And I have a fucking note to my team that says, you know, thou shalt not sell complexity. That is like literally, you know, that's like the devil's work, basically. It's like, or it's like a government. This is like the worst thing that you can do. This is how you make money in like the Eastern Bloc. It's like, you know, you can't park here unless you talk to Drago. Drago will tell you who can park here if you give him $100. It's like, no, dude, that's not how you want to get rich. That what you're doing there is you're trying to bend the wire of reality around your thumb and make someone fucking pay you to get through. It's just no thank you, man.
Right. Fixer culture actually is a limitation on societal productivity.
Yes.
And improving societal productivity is how all of us benefit. That's how you grow the pie.
Yes. That means everyone gets richer at the same time.
Right.
That means you get rich and your neighbor gets rich. And the best part about this is you don't feel bad about getting rich. You don't go, oh, you know, I wish I didn't buy that Ferrari 488. It's like, well, your neighbor's richer now too. You created technology that makes him able to maybe transact faster, save money, whatever it is. It's like, no. Your thing that enriched you, the value that you added to society, also made your neighbor's life fucking better. And now that is a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. That's exactly the right approach to, I think, finances, to technology. I mean, Apple has made a lot of success on their consumer brand by saying, we sell you simplicity, we sell you solutions.
Yes.
And the people who sell you complexity are perhaps rightfully loathed by consumers.
Right. And Apple tucks, obviously Apple is packing tons and tons of technology behind the scenes. They tuck it behind the scenes and they say the consumer doesn't give a shit about this.
Mm-hmm.
The consumer, you know, back in the day, they wanted one wheel, one touch wheel and a button to press to select the song, right? While the Rio Sound Jukebox, which I think was the first MP3 player that I owned, by the way, okay, I begged my parents, I was like, you can fit 14 songs on this, mom and dad.
And it never skips.
And the CD
never fails.
I think the original MP3 player like did skip. There was something that you like couldn't shake it like too hard because it would fucking blow up. But yeah, I remember I had like Creed, My Own Prison was song number one. Number two was like, I think it was Jukebox Hero by Foreigner.
I want you to know everyone younger in our audience is just like, what the hell?
They tuned out. This is, if we look at the data on YouTube, it's like, boop, like, dip. Like, and you dropped. Yeah. You dropped 10% of your audience.
Yeah, and exactly, that's the toxic element that makes financial influencing the way that it is. And unfortunately, there's no remedy to that, right? Like, our cultural antibodies don't protect against that.
But it's also algorithmically driven, right? Because it's, hey, if a wider population of people stick around and watch this idiotic, you know, video of I pressed this button and I made $1 million and then I bought that Ferrari, right? This three-step plan that makes absolutely no sense in reality if you have touched it before. That's what gets impressions, man.
Yeah.
You know, so my videos where I nerd out and get, you know, talk about the finer points of hedging a portfolio. Bro, you think those pop off like, you know?
I actually think there's something very beautiful in what you do, which is the reason that your videos stand out to me is because there is an admission that the rich character is not actually satisfied. And the really rich person may not even be wealthier. It's not a question of wealth. Mm-hmm. It's a question of they understand that there are things that are more important. And they structure their life around achieving those things.
Mm. I think the really rich guy understands that there's no DNA, there's no molecule in your body that says I am a black card owner or that I'm a Ferrari driver. I have a Mercedes. There's no component in any human, right? Because what I find as I move through the world and I go to these airport lounges and I watch people behave badly and I make skits out of it, right? Is I think that when you embody bullshit, a marketing strategy for a company to like, I'm a platinum member. It's like, what's a platinum member? That's a marketing strategy to get you to sign up for a fucking credit card, you dumbass. You've embodied it. You might like, it's like, I am number one, a platinum member. Number two, a Catholic. Number three, like, what?
Right. Your brand is somehow associated to these products that
to a corporate entity
that are being sold to you. Yeah, that's reality.
And I find that I see people. I don't even think they know how insidious it is. How they get attached to these things, and they don't even know how attached they are to them. Where the really rich guy, I think he looks at it, takes it at face value. Like, is this enjoyable? Is this a pleasant experience? Am I getting value out of this?
In fact, I want to pull us back to that point you made at the beginning, which was about a lot of folks doing their work find that their work feels meaningless, feels pointless. I think depression is a crisis in the United States. Millions of people feel depressed, and they solve it medically. They solve it with therapy. They solve it with antidepressants. But for a very large number of them, I think if they quit their job, they would solve their depression. And it is the knowledge that they feel boxed in and oppressed by the inability to quit their job that is the most strong sense of not being rich yet, not of being trapped by one's own belief about how to conduct one's corporate career.
Do you think that the American experience is a story of two experiences, the people that take advantage of the American dream and the people that are enslaved by this this system of, now you have a fucking car that costs $600 a month. Now you have a fucking house that costs $2,500 a month. It just, and now your kids have to go to, you know, college, which costs 10x what it used to. And all of a sudden, can you, you know, this is the question that I get asked a lot. Like, Nick, can I actually quit my job?
Of course. And if you plot the correlation, and you can just do this publicly with census data, the correlation between income and spending, right until you hit about $80,000 or $90,000 a year, every extra dollar households are making, they're finding a way to spend. And I think that's probably correct. You know, there's a lot of things that you need that when you're making $20,000, $30,000 a year, you just don't buy. You suffer. But it also is revealing that there are 40 million households finding a way to make it work on $40,000 a year. And you only get one life. I'm pretty sure that there's something more important than the car that's parked in your driveway.
Sure. Because it, and all this stuff comes down to, I think, pausing and being like, do I get value out of this thing that I'm about to purchase? Does this thing make my life easier? Does it give me time back? Does it allow me to comfort, you know, more comfortably get to work in a stress-free environment? Like, what is this thing doing? Or is this thing just another anchor I'm hanging around, you know, my neck or my family's neck?
And the luxury of being really rich is the opportunity to tell yourself, I'm going to press the reset button. I'm going to do something different.
Right.
And of course, that creates incredible opportunity. That creates the vibrancy in your life and the energy in your life to actually go and do something very different.
So did you press this reset button?
Of course.
Okay. So how was your reset? Was it you basically you're at Two Sigma one day? I know it didn't happen like this. It never happens like this. I'm just,
it was more coincidence in it than people suspect.
Okay. So
I think actually the coincidence part is understated in people's life journeys. I think many people, especially if you get advice from folks about how they became successful, they'll tell you, oh, I worked really hard, I grounded down, blah, blah, blah. But in fact, by pure chance, I knew someone, I took a meeting, I went to an interview, and that's what can change your life course. So the first thing I would say is, I'm not an expert here, don't take my advice, because it's all just chance. But yeah, I took this job at Two Sigma. I learned a tremendous number of things about finance. And what I really realized is there's this tremendous opportunity in which so many other parts of our lives are still living in the 1980s, living in the 1970s when it comes to how people use technology to solve problems. And then Google gave me this maybe once in a lifetime job offer where they said, Max, do you want to come study with a $1 billion budget how advertising changes people's behavior? Which, of course, is crucial to Google's entire business.
Sure.
And the lessons that I learned there were just blew my mind. But it also revealed to me there's tremendous weakness in how people advertise. You know, the incumbents of the world are out there running extremely unpersuasive ads that you see every day. And you're like, why am I getting this? This is just garbage.
Right.
And it's garbage that is costing you money. Right. If you're a customer of that insurance company and they're wasting that money on that advertisement and it was never going to persuade you in a million years, well, that's a thing you bought. That's a thing you as a customer paid for.
So was the first kernel of Coverage Cat, by the way, right? So that's why you're here, Max. Well, I want to hear about Coverage Cat. So what is Coverage Cat?
Coverage Cat is the ability to get precisely the insurance you want and need without having to go and deal with insurance companies.
Okay.
We match your risk profile to all the possible insurance that you could reasonably find. And we just tell you, this is the one to buy. It on average will save you money and get you more appropriate coverage.
And this is quick.
it's reasonably quick. We operate at the speed of the underlying insurance companies. So that's, you know, some of them are still in the fax machine era.
Gotcha. So if you're buying a ticket with a Kayak and you're pulling in all this data and you're getting the best ticket, right? Why are you still attempting to sift through hundreds, if not thousands, of different policies? You're going to pick the wrong one.
I think normal people don't even do that, right? Normal people go to Geico.com, they go to Progressive.com, and they try one or two things.
The company they know.
And unfortunately, they pick the wrong things. They overbuy and overpay for crap they don't need. And they underbuy for the things that could really wreck them.
Okay.
And that's what we fix. And you can save money at the same time as you actually improve your catastrophe coverage.
And when we talk about saving money, what are we talking about? Like hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars, depending on
the... On average, the customers we've seen save $800 or so a year.
Okay.
That's not a guarantee.
So real money.
Some, you know, it depends on the situation you're in, but yeah.
Was the first kernel of Coverage Cat, did that start at Google?
The first kernel of Coverage Cat started way before that. The first kernel started when I was a high schooler, was at a party, and a friend jumped on my head, and I knocked out some teeth on the asphalt.
Okay.
And I spent the next couple of days in hospitals and dentist offices, and you have to sort out EOBs, you have to sort out insurance policies and decide how you're getting covered. I actually convinced my periodontist to split a procedure over the new year so I could double dip, because I saw that there was a calendar date, and he said no patient has ever come to me and asked to split a root canal over 2 days.
Oh my God.
Anyway, so and I discovered all
that's
of this.
That's a life hack, by the way. Split your root canal over two.
This is a life hack that truly is true in taxes, in insurance. For things that are calendar year delineated, understand the contract and the calendar year and find a way to structure across that bridge. Mm. Sometimes that's moving more things into 1 year. Sometimes that's splitting it across the years. I joke that if you get married at midnight on 12/31 of the year,
right,
you have the option of declaring either financial year as a jointly married.
That's fantastic.
I don't think you should choose your wedding date based on tax advice.
Don't worry. This whole video has an asterisk next to it. Yeah. This whole video is like... Lord, yeah, the really rich legal squad will review this.
No, this is legal, but it's just there's more important things than choosing when to get married. I don't know that your partner is going to love choosing a marriage date.
Right, and I believe most of the marriages that happen at midnight are in the state of Nevada.
Yeah. Oh, excellent, great, yeah.
So questionable.
You can annul it by the following morning.
For another $250 fee, processed by a guy in an Elvis costume.
Yeah, so the kernel of Coverage Cat came out of a severe frustration that I had with the insurance industry and a belief that normal people should never spend a minute of their lives sorting this out. Just like normal people shouldn't waste their lives day trading stocks, normal people should have an opportunity to just get the right product without having to think about it.
Because nobody, when we first talked about this, right, nobody either. It's like rich people are undercovered and folks that are, you know, in the middle class are usually overcovered. Like there's this mismatch. There's no optimization for insurance.
Yeah, the insurance is a product that is pushed at you by salespeople and to maximize their commission. And that leads to overpurchase of insurance when you could avoid it.
Right.
And that's very inefficient. That's just a financial anchor on your personal life.
Right.
And also, at the same time as you're doing that, many people don't appreciate that it's possible to do millions of dollars of damage. If you get in a serious crash with somebody, if you come and you break my wrists and I can never work on a computer again.
Right.
And it was through your negligence, you've created you've created my lifetime earning liability.
Right.
And you're going to get sued for that.
Right.
And if you're not insured against that kind of risk, it will be ruinous.
Yeah. Especially if you, depending on what your assets look like, because.
Of course, you can't get blood from a stone. So poor people have avoided this problem because no one will sue them for millions of dollars. But for the moderately wealthy and for the really wealthy, you need to have insurance that induces someone to settle rather than ever taking the thing to court.
Mm. And most people get this wrong.
Of course.
And they have no idea what their policy looks like. And this is why I thought the conversation with you was so interesting, because what did I immediately looked to myself and I was like, I don't know what my policy looks like. You know, it's one of those things that you're like, I guess I just have to get it over with and choose a random policy from
Let
all
me tell
state, you
know? An even crazier optimization. I see people with 3, 4, 5 cars and they've individually insured each of those automobiles.
Okay.
But there's actually a huge opportunity to fix that, where each of those individual policies is costing you hundreds of dollars a month.
Right.
You could get an umbrella policy that covers all of those cars at the same time as it covers your house, as it covers you from many other lawsuits.
Right.
And that kind of thing is not a thing that consumers should ever need to learn about or know about. It's just an inconvenience that you have to learn about it.
Right.
We find that for you automatically and give you a much better deal.
Right.
And I think that that's actually, I mean, the story of investing, the story of personal finance has been people uncomplicating it, simplifying it.
Yes.
And we're aiming to do that for insurance.
The disruption is a disruption that reduces selling complexity and reduces the middleman, right? And this is why you can save money with technology.
Right.
Because technology requires less bodies who are very expensive, and it allows you to simplify this process and pass along that savings. And why not insurance next, right? Like this makes perfect sense to me, but there's some challenges with insurance because it's, from a legal standpoint, it's a complicated market.
Oh, it's heavily regulated and in a very regulatory captured way. Insurance is regulated by each of the 50 states, which you might think could be better, but in practice, it turns out that insurance companies can end up more powerful than, you know, the state of Wyoming, in a real sense. And what that translates
shout
to...
Shout out to Wyoming.
Shout out to Wyoming and their blessed insurance commissioner, who I don't know. And what that ends up happening is you get significant challenges in the market. In Florida, I think many homeowners know there's actually almost no way for them to buy home insurance at any price. And that's a failure of the market. That's a failure of the regulatory regime. And solving those kinds of problems ends up just wasting a lot of people's time. And maybe they end up with the wrong coverage, and then they end up screwed if there's a bad problem.
Mm. So give me some, because there's a wide variety of people, right, that are listening to this and watching this. Like, there's folks that are purchasing their plans for the first time. If you're purchasing your plan for the first time, right, what goes into this equation? You know, you're like, hey, I just graduated from college. Maybe I got my first job.
People are buying insurance for the first time, are changing their life in some exciting way.
Okay.
They just bought a house. They just bought a car they love.
Right.
They're moving.
Things are going well in the right direction.
Sometimes things are going poorly. You know, sometimes you're being forced to downsize. You're getting forced out of a situation. So something is changing.
And let's look at the bright side, Max.
Sure, sure. and change is a time when you're under a lot of pressure to make decisions and you just got to get it done.
Okay. But which can lower your ability to make the right decision.
Which can lower your ability to make the right decision. But the funny thing is, insurance, most people don't know this, is a thing you can revisit at almost any time, at almost no cost. And so it's fine to make whatever choice you made under the gun, but now you have the opportunity
to change it.
To change, to take a beat and fix it and get the right thing. And what I would say is, you can go learn everything I've learned about insurance, but that is a waste of your life. It is better to let a company like Coverage Cat just find you the perfect policy. You don't have to rely on us. There's many independent brokers who will do that for you as well. But we just have that right philosophy of make insurance someone else's problem and we'll get you the right thing.
Right. So what does Coverage Cat do? I log on to Coverage Cat. Let's say I haven't used the software before. I'm looking for a policy. What do you guys do?
Yeah.
You guys pull a huge data set and you basically try to optimize and give me.
Yeah, we look at tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of data points about insurance prices in the places in which we operate.
Simultaneously.
And we find for you the most appropriate policy for your risk. And that's the thing that nobody else does.
So this is one-to-one optimization, basically.
It's one-to-one optimization of your particular financial situation. Mm. There is not a one-size-fits-all element of insurance advice. If you're worth under $1 million and you're carrying $10 million of insurance, you're overinsured. You're just wasting money on a claim that will never happen.
Right.
And we find for you the appropriate match across all of the places that we know how to look.
And there's just in shocking amounts of data points to take into consideration.
It just drives me. Have you ever been to the Arizona-California border? If you've been to the Arizona-California border and you bought gasoline,
okay,
you know the people filling up their tank on the California side are paying $5.50,
right,
and you just drive 3 minutes and boom, you're in Arizona. It's $3.50 a gallon.
Right.
And of course, everyone knows this. It's only the tourists who are filling up on the California side.
Right.
If you're a local. But insurance is 100 times worse than that. I see people paying thousands of dollars for insurance for coverage they don't need. Mm. And they just don't know that a price down the street, because the prices aren't labeled, because the
literally
whole shop,
down the street, the same thing, the same commodity,
the
same specs is on one shop two times as expensive as another shop.
And it's because we've created the complexity surrounding this thing. Mm. It's not like a grocery store. You don't just walk in and see the price.
Right. Don't get me started on the price of eggs, man. I wish I invested in got long eggs a couple months ago.
You know, I think actually many people get inflation challenges incorrect because they don't weight by how much money you spend on a thing. Mm. There's people out there who love eggs.
I love eggs.
Great.
Shout out to Farm Fresh organic eggs. I am all about that.
Buy a dozen eggs a day for the rest of the year, and I guarantee that your rent will still be more.
Right.
So a 5% move on housing inflation.
It's so much more click-worthy, and that's why we're focused on it, right?
Well, I think it's that the salience of the price tag, the price tags in your life, big or small, are a very different availability.
Okay, I'm going to connect the eggs to the insurance. We see the price of eggs on a daily basis. You don't see the price of your rent on a daily basis.
Of course.
And you sure as hell don't see the price of your freaking insurance policy on a daily basis.
Many of our customers literally don't know what they bought. Literally don't.
Right. They signed it when they were stressed out. Make, you know, whatever, a home purchase, a car, maybe having a downsize event, whatever. And they're like, I don't even know what happened, man. I blacked out when I signed that thing.
Yeah.
But what you said about insurance is interesting because you can change it. You're not stuck. You're not stuck in the policy for the rest of your life. It's like,
not only are you not stuck in the policy for the rest of your life, in most states, you can actually change your policy at any time and they'll refund you pro rata at the rate at which you just, so you lose nothing. You could change at any time in many places.
Huh. Okay. So Coverage Cat, basically it functions almost like if you're buying a freaking plane ticket with Kayak, why are you why are you trying to do this yourself with insurance, which, last time I checked, it's probably going to cost you a lot more money over your lifetime than a few plane tickets.
Absolutely. And it scales with wealth. The richer you are, the more you pay in insurance. And that's appropriate because you're buying more insurance to mitigate all of the risk that your wealth is now exposing you to. You're a walking target.
You're basically a walking bank account where if you were to hit someone with your car, or if you were to...
Yeah. I mean, you live in Florida, where I think...
I do.
more insurance
usually
lawsuits...
Usually that starts as an accusation. You live in Florida, and then there's... an accusation.
And I will accuse here, more Florida property and casualty lawsuits occurred than the rest of the 49 states combined, I believe,
really?
Last year. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I've got my own stories about ridiculous things happening. But I don't see. I mean, the reason that I was drawn to your business is because I just you have a big challenge because of the regulatory environment. Every state has its own playbook. But over the long run, this is clearly giving value back to people. I don't ever want to make this decision. I want to let your tech sort it out and sort through all the data points and hand me the best policy. Just like I let Kayak tell me, that this American Airlines ticket is the time that I want to fly and it's cheaper than the United flight or whatever it is.
I mean, the irony is, of course, airlines are actually probably more differentiated than insurance at this point.
Right. Right. Not to name insurance companies, but company A, it doesn't taste or, feel any different than company B, right? It's not like wearing
you're buying a contract. And that contract, you may even think is different, but in fact is generally so standard as to be identical to the competitor's contract.
Right. So it's not organic. It's not grass-fed. It's the same damn thing.
Maybe you like their advertisement a lot.
Well, and that's why they spend so much money on advertising, to differentiate themselves.
Exactly. It's them and Budweiser.
Really?
Sure.
The two biggest advertisers of insurance and the alcohol industry?
Not biggest, but it's a... you need to advertise more to differentiate your brand when your product is more standard.
I'm more of a Miller Lite guy myself, but
okay, well,
I have taste.
Got to you in a different way.
I have taste. So, okay. So what happens now, right? You you graduate from Y Com, right? Guys, if you don't know what Y Combinator is, it's a really prestigious foundry of businesses, an incredible amount of advisory that goes into it. There's this network, there's access to fundraising.
We talked about, is it similar to Harvard? The analogy that I would give is Harvard, you go, you pay $400,000, $500,000. Uh-huh. Y Combinator, you go, they give you $500,000.
Right.
So it's the inverse of Harvard.
It's the inverse Harvard.
Right. And it comes, of course, with a very low acceptance rate.
Right. So a super elite group. How many businesses graduate from these guys every year?
It's getting bigger. Several hundred a year these days, I
okay.
think.
Okay. So several hundred students, we'll call them, even other businesses. And some of the biggest brands and most game-changing companies you've ever heard of have come
Airbnb,
through.
Airbnb, Coinbase.
Right.
Yeah.
Just to name a few of the heavy hitters, but what you graduate from the program, right? You incubate this idea, you've gone to market. Now it's time to get to work. What's the next step? Like, do you guys immediately start raising money? Do you start building out a mark? Like, what happened? Like,
I think people are under the illusion that there's some kind of road that's plotted for you, but in fact, yes. you're doing everything all at once. It's not this like, oh, first I get the money and right. then I get the power. And right. then it's not a Robert De Niro scene, you know.
And there's no bullet point sheet where they're like, okay, now you're on bullet point two. Yeah. So don't skip to three.
The narrative arc is only created in some kind of post hoc reductionist view where, you know, you're sitting on the interview couch and, right. and you say some crap about how you saw the whole thing coming.
Right.
But in practice, it's a miasma of fog, and you have no idea what's going on, yeah. and you just have to go do everything at the same time.
I'm adding miasma to my vocabulary, by the way, after this episode. So this is the thing that I am seeing, because I know I saw it in my own journey. There is no roadmap. It's iterative. You see the next step when you're really close to the next step. You have some long-term vision that you're wobbling towards, but it's ugly and it's not pretty. Even the grads of a YCOM program still don't get handed some kind of, now you have the golden YCOM roadmap, your success is guaranteed. Not at all, right? I mean,
yeah, let's talk about Elon Musk for a moment.
Yeah.
So Twitter obviously shrank massively, tons of layoffs. I feel my heart goes out to all those folks. What Elon Musk needed to give to Twitter that I think he has so far failed to do is, when you're that last man standing, when you're one of the few people on your team who's still there, mm-hmm. you need to have the faith that Elon Musk has a vision of where he's going.
Yeah.
And with electric cars, what's the myth? It goes fast. You're gonna love driving it. With rockets, they sell themselves. Like, you don't need to sell that to anyone. That's ensconced in the human mythology of go to the moon, right? Twitter is a platform about yelling at people on the internet.
Anonymously.
And I'm not sure that he's painted a picture about why you should be excited to further that.
So I think that he hasn't verbalized it, but I think he understands that ultimately Twitter in its V1 stage under Dorsey was just like, it started to lose utility. I think it started to lose mega utility for the app. For it had utility for maybe 10,000 people of however many users. It didn't have mass appeal. And I think what he's doing is he's trying to get lean, and he's trying to get closer to a tool that has some value other than yelling at people anonymously with cartoon headshots.
As you get lean, you are under tremendous pressure as the person running the business to tell people why they should stay, even as all of their friends are going.
Mm. So you're saying the communication and the leadership, like, even if he has a vision tucked away in the back of his brain, that doesn't mean shit until his team sees that and aligns on that vision.
Yeah, I think, in fact, if anything, he has more rope than most for the average tech employee. Like, there's more faith in Elon Musk that right. he does have something in the back of his brain, but you can't drag that out at the same time as you cull and cull and cull.
Mm. Because morale just hits the floor.
People don't quit because of reasons that are related to, it's not paying enough or whatever. People quit because it feels pointless.
Mm. It feels pointless because then they start to feel like someone you know, selling this meaningless product or being a part of a meaningless mission, right, where that it's a, you know, a road to nowhere scenario. Mm-hmm. I hope that that is not where Twitter's going, because in the social landscape, we have very few options. We have very few options, and the dice is loaded on every single one of them. Twitter.
You've got Mastodon. You can toot on Mastodon.
What the hell is Mastodon?
Let's see. Okay, well, there we go.
Toot. I'm out. For that reason, I'm out.
You don't tweet on Mastodon. You toot on Mastodon.
They blew that opportunity.
You need more playfulness in your life.
Yeah, I know. I got to get out more. What's happening with social media is every platform has a mega, mega issue with it. The cleanest shirt, in my opinion, is Google and YouTube, because the ecosystem is truly rewarding to creators and the people that create the bulk of the content that people consume. TikTok was selling, basically selling fame, but without any financial.
Just as Instagram was.
Instagram was, but Instagram had this. You believed that there was commerce attached to it. You believed there was a deeper sense of connection that you were building. You're really accessing an audience. Now, Instagram is just a bot farm where my followers get harassed on a daily basis with Nicholas Crown with an E, Nicholas Crown with a K. And it's just a nightmare. It's a complete nightmare. So just my existence on social media platforms is being weaponized by like low grade hackers in countries where, quite frankly, I don't even blame them for creating these accounts and trying to get money out of people.
I've got great faith that deepfake Nicholas Crown is the future of Nicholas Crown.
Better and more entertaining.
Yeah, I feel like we can cut out the human part and really see improvement on those numbers.
If you guys want some more skits, just talk to Max. We're going to deepfake me and... We're going to have some copywriters.
Yeah, you should move to a state where your likeness is stronger protections. Yeah. California's calling, maybe.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I've talked to a few different entrepreneurs, and I've tried to clone myself multiple times, by the way. It's really, really hard to do. Vocal synthesis, you need hundreds of hours of really clean speech. So people like... A guy like Elon Musk would be someone easy to clone. A guy like Gary Vee would be someone easy to clone.
You know what one of the first corpuses of machine translation ever was?
Who?
You got the exact same problem for language translation. You need a really high quality version in English. You need a really high quality version in another language.
Okay.
By law, the Canadian Parliament has to put out their laws in French and English.
Really?
Yes, because of Ottawa. Okay. And so you ended up with this incredible corpus for English to French translation.
Really?
In the early days of machine translation.
Okay.
That sped up that process a lot.
Isn't that brilliant? And how creative is that? The person that was like...
Totally free, exactly.
Totally free, ready to go, plug it into the robot. And
what did the French get from it? They got a great machine translation program.
That's fantastic. Good for them. Good for them. Mm. What I'm trying to do now is like assess whether the really rich sort of methodology, which for me is about humility, it's about promoting collaboration, ultimately trying to put more value out there into the world, which, by the way, makes you rich and it makes other people rich. We talked about this in the beginning. Like, have you seen that type of behavior with leaders in your career? I just know by the way you reached out to me, you were offering me a ton of value. It didn't feel transactional when we first met and I was learning about Coverage Cat. I felt like you were embodying those principles. Have you seen this in action in your career? Is this something that you have noticed when you watch the skits, or is this something that seems like make-believe?
Nobody is ever proud of the deal that they struck. But many people are proud of the way that they treated people and the relationships. I think the very wealthy have the cultural upbringing that constantly reminds them that the relationship is the thing that's important. Mm-hmm. And whether they're very good at faking it or whether they truly believe it, it's better if you truly believe it for what it's worth. I think that changes your behavior and reminds you constantly that it's not about screwing someone over on this deal so you can get yours. It's about the long-term value there.
There is no way to win long term by screwing over anyone, right? If the game keeps going.
It depends on the game. In extraordinary circumstances, let's take venture capital for a moment.
Okay.
One in 1,000 startups drives the bulk of the portfolio for venture capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, 1 in 1,000 is Uber, 1 in 1,000 is WeWork, 1 in 1,000 is Google.
Yep.
And when
and that 1 in 1,000 pays for the other 999.
And it pays for the other 999.
That's the
septuple over.
Absolutely. J-shaped curve.
That's exactly that curve. And when you find yourself in that situation, it flips from being an iterative game, a game where you replay and replay and replay with the same participants, to suddenly being, this is it.
Mm.
This is it. This is the only game.
Okay.
And in that moment, you actually see the worst behaviors of people in finance, because suddenly there's no next deal.
Okay, because this is the deal that's basically paying for you, your kids, and your grandkids. This is the generational wealth moment for everybody, basically. Yeah. And so in that generational wealth moment, you're saying that you see some nasty behavior.
That is the time when the script totally flips.
Interesting. Now, if can we zoom in on that a little bit closer? In that moment, what happens, I will argue, is that it goes from a non-zero-sum game, basically everyone can win, to a zero-sum game. You go from Jordan, Michael Jordan, off the court, making everyone rich, just being a basketball player, to being, now it's Jordan Knicks. Someone's got to win and lose. Is that what happens when we zoom in on one deal as opposed to a suite of deals?
Of course. And in fact, it's because it's the nexus of everyone trying to take a piece of the value that's been created. And there's no more future hope.
Hmm.
Whenever you start a company, always at the beginning, you have nothing but hope. You have mm-hmm. nothing but the dream. And everyone's along for that ride. But at the moment that you're selling out the company, that you're going IPO, that you're selling it to someone, then it's everyone taking the chunk of the pie.
Mm, because they recognize that this might be the last opportunity to do
and
so.
If it's something that's Uber sized, that's WeWork sized, absolutely.
Right.
Look at the raw deals that happen to the participants in those companies. That is very revealing.
Hmm. This is interesting how a lifetime of non-zero-sum games can become a zero-sum game in this moment of an exit.
You know, it brings me to my favorite finance movie of all time, which is Margin Call.
Uh-huh.
And in it, Kevin Spacey's character asks the CEO, the head of the bank that they're working at, you know, we're in the business of both buying and selling. No one right. will ever work with us again. And the head of the bank replies, this is the big one. This is it.
Right.
And I would argue it's very rare that you're in that case. 99.99% of the time you're in this other iterative game.
Right. And so on a population level, my argument is 99.999% of people are always in a non-zero-sum game environment. So yeah. If you had to pick to be cutthroat, competitive, vicious, or collaborative, open-minded, creative, most of the time, you should pick collaborative, open-minded, creative.
The most cutthroat and vicious people I know do it with such a veneer of happiness that you smile as you're being stabbed.
Mm.
And if you can pull that off, I think you've got an excellent opportunity in some of the categories of finance.
I mean, but you know, you see through it. You see through it. How effective can it be if you see through it?
The true players can still satisfy you even as you know you're getting screwed. And that is the mystery. Like,
That,
interact.
By the way, that's our viral cut. It's just the true players can satisfy you even as you're being screwed.
It's what separates the middling investment bankers from the best. It's what separates the extraordinary from the less extraordinary. If you've ever met a top-tier political player, I've had the pleasure of briefly meeting some top-tier political players. And when you meet Barack Obama, he will seem like he is excited to meet you, which is a joke. I think we can all agree he was not excited to meet me. But he
was... I don't know. You're a pretty cool guy, Max.
He made you feel like you were the only person on earth. And I think great deal makers in business can do the same thing.
Max Cho, Coverage Cat. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you.